DNA, diversity, and life. How genetics is transforming our understanding of species and management practices. This is the second forum in the 2016 Fenner Forum series, hosted by the Fenner School of Environment and Society at the Australian National University in Canberra. This forum took place on the 25th of May 2016.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Steve Dovers, the Director of the Fenner School. Just welcome you to ANU, the Fenner School, and in welcoming you here, I acknowledge the Australia's First People, the stewards of the land, traditional lands we're standing on, and I pay my and our respects to the elders of the Ngunnawal people, both past and present. That's about it for me, though I will say, I'm the director of the school, you think I know what all the people do, I come to these because I find out what they do, because most of the time they're in the field. They don't give seminars here, so I never get to find out. So this is like the all-star band from your local town who never perform locally, so I'm looking forward to it as much as you are. And I'd welcome the chair, Dr. Chris Fraser, who will run the rest of the event and introduce our other speakers. Chris.
Thanks, Steve. So essentially all I'm going to do at this stage is just introduce the next lot of people. All right, so just before we start, can I just remind everyone please to turn your phones onto silent, but don't turn them off because I'm going to need them on for my talk where we're going to do a bit of trial interaction stuff with phones. We'll see how that goes. So this forum is all about how we at Fenner School are starting to use molecular genetic techniques to address questions about wildlife conservation and just studying biodiversity patterns globally. And we've got some really cool speakers here today. George has just finished his PhD on macaws in the Amazon, which is a very exciting topic and great pictures to show you. Sam, the next one along, He works on all sorts of cute and furry things in various ways, looks at the impacts of fire and so on. David Lindemeyer probably doesn't need an introduction. He's a very famous ecologist who works on everything and anything in Australia. And Xenia just finished her honours a few months ago looking at genetic diversity in seaweed. And I work on also a bunch of different organisms from seaweed and invertebrates to life on Antarctic volcanoes. So it should be a real mix-up tonight. So we're going to start with David, who's going to give a general overview of the value of molecular techniques.
Thanks very much for coming tonight. So I've got about 8 minutes to summarise a little narrative about our experiences with conservation and what we call demographics, or studies of animals, and genetics, and how those things intersect in some very surprising ways. So, essentially, most Canberrans would be familiar with this creature that eats your vegetables, walks on your roof with very heavy boots, and creates havoc in your roof for nesting. But it has a close relative. This animal here is the mountain brush-tailed possum, which almost all Canberrans will never know. It's a wet forest animal that has this amazing distribution from Melbourne to Gladstone in Queensland. And many years ago, the Ministry for Agriculture and Forestry in New Zealand wanted to find a parasite that could be used to control the 70 million common brush-tailed possums that occur in New Zealand. And they thought the best thing to do would be to find a parasite that lived in the closely related mountain brush-tailed possum to control the animal. So that became my wife's PhD. And as part of the work, we decided to look at how this animal how it changes across its distribution. So it's a wet forest animal, lives in parts of Victoria and these beautiful wet forests, but it goes right through to the wet forest and rainforest, right through into southeast and central Queensland. And this is not a mountain brush-tailed possum. This is an animal that shows what we call a classic climb. It varies from being very small with very very short extremities like its toes and its ears in Queensland to become a much larger beastie by the time it gets to Victoria. So this is a classic form of change in an animal's morphology. It's called Bergman's rule in terms of body size. And Allen's rule has to do with the length of your extremities. And so what we thought was going to happen is that we were going to have this climb. of change from small and small and furry in Queensland to big and boofy and large in Victoria. And basically it's got to do with conserving body heat. So the closer you get to the poles, the better you can conserve your body heat if you're larger. So what we duly did was that when we caught these animals, the mountain brush-tailed possums, across all of these, a whole range of sites from Melbourne right through to Gladstone, we would sedate these animals, and you really do need to sedate these animals. This is a large possum that quite happily take a finger off if you're not careful with what you do. Once we've sedated these animals, then we start the process of measuring them under sedation. So we use a drug called Zolotil, which is sedates the animal. We can work with the animal to measure it before then. We put it back into a hessian bag before we release the animal the next day so that it doesn't get eaten by a fox or a dingo. So we started to measure these creatures, their head length, their tail length, as part of also measuring all the parasites that they had. And we have to make sure that we deliver the animals back exactly to where they've been caught previously, so we don't mess up their home ranges. And lo and behold, then we create a data set looking at the animal's head length, its eye size, its skull width, all these kinds of things. We also wanted to know if there were relationships between the kinds of parasites they had and how it affected their body condition. That's another story. And we didn't get the decline that we were hoping to see. Something strange happened. We ended up with two populations. We ended up with a southern population of animals with its body morphology down here and a northern population up here. So this just didn't fit what we were supposed to see, given that it happens with animals like koalas, it happens with wombats, it happens with tiger quolls, but the mountain brush-tailed possums hadn't read the mammal book and they didn't follow the decline. What actually happens is that the morphometrics or the morphology of the animals shows these two distinct groups of animals. And then when you take blood samples and you do the same thing, you discover that the genetics shows two distinctly different groups of animals. In fact, the differences between the northern and the southern populations are much greater than, for example, many of the species of gazelles that you might find in the savannas of Africa. So it turns out that we didn't have a decline because we've got two species of possums. So we've got a new one, which was completely unexpected. We were looking for parasites to control the common brush-tailed possum in New Zealand. We ended up with a new species of possum. As a sideline, the only parasite that had any effect on the pathology of the mountain brush-tailed possum was this wonderful worm, about so big, that lives in the liver of the mountain brush-tailed possum. And it's called Ophidascarus robertsi, it's a beautiful name. And it didn't quite work for introduction to New Zealand because the final stage of that animal's life cycle is actually a carpet python. And so the New Zealanders weren't keen for us to introduce not only a new worm, but also the carpet python. So we ended up with a new species of possum, and we named it after the stats guru who actually found the statistical pattern. So Ross Cunningham, who still works here, and fantastically for Ross, he gave his exit seminar for his PhD just recently. He's just turned 70, and we're hoping to encourage him to apply for a DECRA, or a Discovery Early Career Researcher. Wonderful story. Ross was actually my PhD supervisor when I did my PhD just a few years ago, and now Ross has finished his. But he was the person who found this amazing pattern, and then found the pattern in the genetics as well, and was able to see through this wonderful thing called Procrustes analysis, which dates back a couple of thousand years, that the patterns match one another, and that really told us that we were dealing with two different things. So the northern animal is a short-eared possum, and it has short ears, a longer tail, and shorter feet. So it doesn't fit with Allen's rule or Bergman's rule in terms of body extremities. And so this is what we're dealing with: the short-eared possum, the mountain brush-tailed possum, and Sam Banks and I, and Sam's going to talk fairly soon, have talked about trying to find where the overlap zone is, where these species actually segregate. And we're looking for an honours student or a PhD student to look at this kind of thing. So there's the mountain brush-tailed possum. and there's the short-eared possum. And it turns out that in places like Hills or Sanctuary, they've actually had a short-eared possum in the same cage as a mountain brush-tailed possum, and they're opposite gender, and they've looked at each other for many, many years, and nothing's happened, and now we know why that's the case. And we also know that climatically, these two things are quite separated as well. And here's our overlap zone here that we really need to get a handle on where these things overlap. So still lots of things to find out about this animal. Sam is going to talk about mammal responses to very high severity fires. So this is from the big fires in 2009 in Victoria. Most people are thinking that when you have these kinds of big fires, what happens is that everything's killed and then everything recolonises these burnt sites from the outside. The only way to really understand what's going on is to match genetics and demography of animals. And I'm not going to talk any more about that because Sam's got some great stories about that. Looking at some of our wonderful native animals like the bush rat. In other studies that we've done, we've looked at these kinds of animals called, this is called Bullinger skink, Marethia boulangeri, or some people call it blue lingerie. And this has a very, very wide distribution. And the thinking is maybe this animal is really many different species. And so one of the things that we wanted to look at is how does this animal colonise replanted and restored woodlands? And how does it relate to their body condition? Are good conditioned woodlands good places for good conditioned animals? This might be a reflection of how effective the restoration process is. But that would be messed up if you were actually looking at many different species of skinks. But it turns out that Bullinger skink is actually one species. And there is no relationship between the condition of woodlands and the condition of animals. But sometimes things get really messed up when you don't do the genetics. So most people would be familiar with this animal. And what has happened in many cases is that these animals have been had their habitats destroyed, or they've ended up being taken into markets and then unsold and then taken into captivity to be rehabilitated before they've been released. And the horrible news is that this isn't one species. This turns out to be a whole series of species. And animals that have been taken from the wild, rehabilitated and then released, have been released into places where they didn't previously occur. So it's one of the key lessons about this kind of conservation and genetic studies and demographic studies is that you've actually really got to put them together to really understand how you don't mess things up, like has happened in parts of Southeastern Asia with this wonderful animal. So I think about this demographics and genetics and conservation as more than like country and Western. Obviously, these things lead to exciting discoveries. Who would have imagined that in the year 2000... you would discover a new species of possum, and not just a little piddly thing, a 3.5 kilogram large species of mountain brush-tailed possum, new to science, something that lives less than 50 kilometres from where we are right now. So these things give us more than the sum of their parts. They tell us new things that you can't even imagine when you start the research. So true serendipity and things that you often can't plan for when you do the research. And to me, that really illustrates the sort of cross-disciplinary approach that we have to things in the Fenner School, working together to solve some of these problems, but also to make some really amazing new discoveries. So I've done my 8 minutes. Thanks very much. And I'll pass the baton to the next speaker. Thanks very much.
Thanks, David. Now, I probably didn't make it clear at the beginning, but the questions are all going to be at the end. So you have to sit through all of us before you can quiz David on anything he just said. So write them down, hang on to them, and we'll get to them at the end. All right. So as I said, I work on a range of different things, from seaweed in the tropics and temperate worms, right down to Antarctica. So I thought today I'd just talk about some of my Antarctic research. And it's how I'm using genetics to look at how volcanoes have fostered life in the Antarctic, in this freezing continent where life otherwise struggles. Now, as you know, the Earth's undergone many periods of climate change in its past, and particularly over the last couple of million years in the Pleistocene, we've gone through more or less regular periods of climate change. And at the moment, we're in a really warm interglacial period, which is at the top of the graph here. Now, this graph was made in 1984. We're actually somewhere up here now, thanks to increasing human carbon dioxide emissions. But 20,000 years ago was the peak of the last ice age. And at that time, there was a lot more water drawn up as ice on land, as glaciers, and a lot more ice that covered the sea. So sea levels were a lot lower, and the shape of the continents looked very different. Now, I want to try an experiment here. I want to try a quiz using a program called Socrative. So those of you who have smartphones, could you quickly try to log in to socrative.com? That's all you have to type in your internet browser. And it'll ask you what room, and you type in VX01YVD0. All right, I'll just give you a few more seconds for that. So now just select your answer. Was ocean level at the peak of the last ice age, was the sea level 2 metres lower than today, 21 metres lower than today, 120 metres lower than today, or 201 metres lower than today? There's definitely a 2 in it somewhere. That's the clue. All right, we've got 11 people answering, a few more still to go. Okay, let's just see how that goes out of 9 out of 11. So we've got equal votes for 21 metres lower than today and 120 metres lower than today, and a couple of votes for 201. Those are all really vastly different. Nobody thought it was only 2 metres, so that's reassuring, because it is quite a large number. It's not the largest, but the right answer is C. It was 120 metres lower than today. So with ongoing climate change, we can expect sea level rise to have some pretty impressive consequences as the glaciers in Antarctica and elsewhere melt. And obviously, as the climate changes, whether it's going into an ice age or coming out of an ice age, plants and animals have to try to adapt or move. Many of them shift their distributions. Generally, they move towards the equator as we go into an ice age and towards the poles as the Earth warms. And we can track some of these movements in the past by looking at contemporary genetic patterns. So this is a hypothetical butterfly species distributed all around the Northern Hemisphere. And every spot on the map represents a different population that has a different genetic variant represented by a different colour. Now, if we went into an ice age, all of those really northern populations get wiped out. And then whichever lineage is the first to recolonise this space has plenty of opportunity to move around and to reproduce and fill. And so what you end up with is a loss of genetic diversity in areas that have had recent recolonisation, and lots of genetic diversity in areas that haven't been affected by climate change in the past. And this sort of pattern has been shown in the Northern Hemisphere for heaps of different species, including grasshoppers, spruce trees, hedgehogs, bears, and even newts. Thousands and thousands of species show evidence of moving towards the equator with ice ages and then back towards the poles as the Earth warms. But obviously the Northern Hemisphere is very, very different to the Southern Hemisphere. This is a pole-centric couple of maps. And you can see that southern continents are very oceanic. The Southern Hemisphere is very oceanic. And Antarctica is surrounded by a whopping great big ocean. So if plants and animals are trying to move towards the poles in the Southern Hemisphere, they're going to struggle a little bit because there's an ocean in the way. So I'm interested in what happened to the plants and animals that are in Antarctica right now during past climate change. This is a satellite view of Antarctica. You can see it's fairly icy. But wherever there isn't ice, you get diverse mosses and invertebrates and all sorts of other plants and animals occurring. I'm going to do another quick quiz here, but just to speed things up because my 8 minutes has been eaten away a fair bit, I might just do a show of hands. How much Antarctic land do you think is not covered by ice, is available for plants and animals to live on? Who thinks 30%? 13%? About half? 3%? Just over half? And 0.3%? Only a few. It's 0.3%. So Antarctica is 99.7% covered in ice. And there isn't really much space for plants and animals to live. But this space is shown here in pink. That space is covered in diverse plants and animals. So have they been in Antarctica throughout past ice ages, which models show really blanketed the continent in ice, or have they come back on after the ice age? Well, most of the species, more than half of the species in Antarctica, are found nowhere else in the world. So that's a really good indication that they haven't come back on since the last ice age, that they've been there for millions of years. But if the continent was even more covered in ice than it is today, how on earth could so many plants and animals have survived through past ice ages? So my idea is that they might have sheltered on volcanoes. This is Mount Erebus, and you can see that there's not a lot of snow and ice around the summit, where there's a lot of steam coming out. This is a South Sandwich Island in the Antarctic, and where there's steam coming out of the volcano, you get these very lush moss fields growing. This is steam coming out of a small vent in the ground, and all around it you've got diverse communities. So it looks like volcanoes can help life to survive in Antarctica. Another way they might be able to do this, other than just melting ice and snow, is they form quite complex cave systems under the glaciers. So wherever there's an Antarctic volcano that's covered by ice, the steam from the volcano can melt these large cave systems, and they can be up to 20 degrees in there, and around the mouths of the caves you get quite a lot of light coming in. So it could be a really good place for plants and animals to live, but we don't have any evidence of plants and animals living in the caves yet. So one of the first things I did when I was trying to test this idea was to try to find out whether plants and animals are in those caves today, because that would help us know if they could have sheltered in them through past ice ages. So I got samples from caves on Mount Erebus. I didn't go there myself. I got a colleague who had been there to collect soil for a different purpose, and I used his soil samples and analysed them using a technique called environmental DNA analysis, which is basically where you look at DNA in the soil, because any plants and animals that are living on or in the soil will drop their DNA into the soil. So by looking at DNA from soil or water, you can get an idea of what sort of species occur in the community. So there were 9 caves around Mount Erebus that I got soil samples from, and from some of these we found good evidence of plants and animals. In this cave called Harry's Dream, I found DNA from green algae. In a cave called Warren Cave, I found springtails, which are little insects, mosses, green algae, nematodes, and even oligochaetes. And in an ice chimney called 22 Blue, I found evidence of arthropods, I'm not quite sure what, because they don't match anything in the online database, and some green algae. So there's pretty good evidence that there could be diverse plants and animals living in these caves. But a little bit of spanner in the works was that in Warren Cave, I also found evidence of ash trees, soybeans, and kiwi fruit. Only in Warren Cave, not in any of the other sites, caves or not. So at first, this was a real bummer, because I was thinking, oh, no, obviously there's human contamination in the cave, so how do we know that these Antarctic species that we found were not brought in by humans? But something interesting has come out of that, because the ash wood in particular was interesting because that's what they used to make skis out of in the old days. And so I got to thinking about the early expeditions to the area. Now, Scott's ill-fated expeditions in the early 1900s, they did do a trip up Mount Erebus. And this is the map from Scott's diary that shows the route they took up Mount Erebus. And if I twist that to be oriented the same way as the Google Earth image, you see that they actually seem to have walked right past Warren Cave. And they talk a lot about making supply depots along the way. So it's possible that some of those human contaminants have come from those early trips. There were soybeans taken down to the Ross Sea region by the first Japanese expedition at the same year that Scott's voyage went down there. And many of the other things that I found DNA from in that cave are matching things on the supply list of Scott's voyage. So that's not confirmed yet, but it's looking quite exciting that we can see a little bit of history in the soil as well as some of the contemporary DNA. More broadly, though, this idea that volcanoes sheltered life through ice ages, if it's true, we should expect to see, because of like the butterfly example I showed you, we should expect to see lower diversity moving away from volcanoes. And in a GIS-based biodiversity analysis, just looking at what species are where, we did find a really sharp reduction in species diversity with distance from volcano across the whole of Antarctica. So it looks as though volcanoes are biodiversity hotspots. And I wanted to look at this on a finer scale. So in February this year, I went to Deception Island at the tip of the Antarctic Peninsula, and I collected soil samples from many different sites around the island. Now, this is an active volcano, and some of the soil there can reach 100 degrees or more. This is high up on a ridge where it was freezing that day, utterly freezing, but you can see the soil was 45.8 degrees because of the geothermal heat. And we get quite a lot of mosses and other organisms growing on these hot spots high up on the volcano. You can see how cold it is by what I'm wearing, and yet we've got diverse life thriving in 30-degree soil. So I was taking soil samples up on ridges and in the intertidal zone from these really hot spots. You can see a hot spot here because it's so hot it's dry, even though the waves are lapping over it. And then I'm taking samples from the hotspot and increasing distances away and trying to see over what sort of scales we see diversity differences. And those results are yet to come. But that's the kind of work that we're looking at. And this sort of research, even though it tells us a lot about the impacts of past climate change, that's very useful for informing how we deal with future climate change. But more broadly, it just helps us to understand what sorts of processes drive evolution and patterns of biodiversity across the Earth. So I've probably used up way more than my 8 minutes, and so I'm going to hand over now to Sam.
Thanks, Brit. And hi, everyone. So my name's Sam. I'm a biologist here in the Fenner School. And I guess scientists like me like to spend an awful lot of time in their careers sort of studying environmental changes and how that affects natural systems, whether we should do anything about it, if so, what. Today I'm actually going to talk about fire, which is not really environmental change or something new in the Australian environment, but the patterns of fire that we see in the Australian bush are changing quite substantially because of things like climate change, direct fire management, or fragmentation of our natural ecosystems. So in some ways, we know a lot about fire. It's, you know, part of almost what defines our natural environment in Australia, but there are some things that we don't know that much about with regard to fire, and some of that relates to the role that fire has in shaping the evolutionary diversity of our natural populations and their capacity to adapt to future environmental change. So, having just said that, it's a bit of a lie. We do know a fair bit about the role that fire's had in the long-term evolution of a lot of our biodiversity, particularly for plants. So a lot of plants have traits that have been strongly shaped over evolutionary history by fire patterns. So probably the most characteristic one is re-sprouting that we see in our eucalypts. So about 60 million years ago, they seem to have evolved the capacity to re-sprout after fire from little epicormic buds. So if fire comes through, it looks like it kills all the trees. They get these little shoots coming out from buds underneath the bark, and 6 months later, lo and behold, they've got a living forest again. So that's been one of the traits that's really enabled them to adapt and really dominate a lot of our Australian environments. There's been some cool work in other parts of the world that's looked at how genetic variation actually underpins variability in fire adaptations within populations. So some neat work in Spain has looked at these weird shrubs, I think it's a Mediterranean gorse, something that'd be a weird here. But they basically found that in areas that are more fire-prone, these shrubs actually become more flammable, which actually seems like a bit of a dud adaptation. But if you're a species that does really well under fire, and for instance, seeds really heavily after fire events, being flammable, burning at the drop of a hat and taking out your neighbours is not a bad thing, because you clear out the competition from the neighbourhood and your seedlings do really well. And there's been shown to be strong genetic components underpinning those sorts of adaptations. So when we come to animals, which is mostly what I work on, they don't tend to burn so well, so we don't know that much. We don't have such a good understanding of the role that fire's played in their evolution. But to a certain extent, we can also, instead of looking at the role of fire in sort of fire-related traits like we can in plants, which we don't really recognise in animals, another way of looking at the long-term genetic or evolutionary effects of a process like fire is possibly as a bit of an environmental filter that removes a lot of genetic diversity from populations over time. And so the way that might work is, so places like Victoria, where we have the Black Saturday fires in our Mountain Ash Forest about 7 years ago, we get these periodic really large fires that come through the ecosystem. They kill a lot of animals and plants, and so if populations in the system have to repeatedly recover from small numbers of survivors or recolonisers from these really serious fires, they're going to lose a lot of genetic diversity over time. So does this mean that the Australian animals that we have in these sorts of places are sort of inbred evolutionary dead ends with no capacity to sort of respond to any future environmental changes? Or do they actually have innovative ways to cope with these sorts of fire events? So we've used a bit of sort of ecological and genetic detective work, to kind of figure out how they deal with this. So I've done a fair bit of work with David since I've been here at ANU, and one of the places where we work most often is the Victorian Central Highlands. So these are tall mountain ash forests that are dominated by the world's tallest flowering plants, Eucalyptus regnans. This is where David was talking about the mountain brush-tailed possum work earlier. In 2009, this area was affected by the Black Saturday fires. This is a map of part of the fire event. You may know some of the towns being Hillsville, Marysville and other areas around there. By any measure, this was a major tragedy for people who lived in the area, and it was certainly a really big ecological event. So we've been working here for, say, 25 years. That's not me, that's David, but I've been working here for a while. We've done a lot of work on animals and plants in this area, but after the Black Saturday fires, the work has in some ways reinvigorated because this was a major event that kind of defines the history of this environment, at least within our lifetimes. So we've looked at a lot of plants and animals, and one of the things we have looked at, amongst others, is what are the effects of big events like this on the genetic diversity of our animals? So one of them that is a personal favourite is the agile antichinus, which is a pretty common animal around here, probably the most common native mammal that we get in our tall forests in this region. Go on any bushwalk in the Manji National Park and you'll pass dozens of them, but not know it. They're kind of like a Tasmanian devil that's been through a shrinking machine or something like that. But they're about as big little predators. So they were hit pretty hard by the fire. They declined in abundance by about 80 or 90% in the burn areas. But when we looked at their patterns of genetic diversity, they hadn't lost any genetic diversity, and their spatial genetic patterns were exactly the same before and after the fire. And they totally recovered within about 2 or 3 years in abundance. And a lot of the small mammals in that ecosystem did pretty much the same thing, so they got a remarkable capacity to bounce back. And the genetic data showed that all the population recovery was driven by survival within the fire event itself, so they managed to survive in these big hollow-bearing trees that persist through the fires or deep gullies, and they recovered locally. They didn't recolonise from outside. One of the other animals that we work on, David's already talked about, this is another short-haired possum. You'll recognise it as a mountain brush-tailed possum from the year show. I was hanging around in the forest fitting radio collars to these animals in the week leading up to the fires, doing sort of behavioural esoteric study that I do. And hightailed it out of there on the Friday night when I saw the forecast. The possums clearly couldn't do the same. So I came back about 2 months later, which was the earliest we could get in, and found that all the animals that we'd collared, which was about 20 of them, were perfectly fine, alive and kicking around well. So they did really well through the fire events. There were minor genetic effects if you look hard enough, but nothing really to write home about. We did find that the burnt areas, for about 2 years after the fire, seemed to be considerably poorer habitat than unburnt areas, and they sort of declined in survival a little bit, but then came right back up to where they were. So nothing too major there. They seemed to do fairly well in response to bushfires. One thing that we did find from looking at long-term data from this species was that these forests and lots of other areas in our landscape are sort of full of really nice parts of the landscape, like these deep gullies, which are important refuges that we have. In Victoria, in these forests, they're typically characterised by old-growth mountain ash forest or cool temperate rainforest, and these areas rarely get burnt, and they're also important refuges against things like drought as well. And we found that populations that were in these kinds of areas tended to have really high levels of survival among animals that lived in them, and they had much higher genetic diversity than other areas of the landscape, like these slopes and ridges that tend to get burnt and hit by drought quite regularly. So one of the sort of insights from that was possums aren't really affected by fire events so much, but one of the really important things was the spatial environmental variation. So these kind of important deep gullies that are really important but very small components of the landscape really sort of punch above their weight in terms of their conservation importance. So even for species that seem quite ubiquitous and everywhere in these forests, in a lot of parts of the landscape, they're actually subsidised by the sort of really high productivity and genetic diversity that you get in these little gullies and areas. So in terms of conserving parts of the landscape, this is sort of one of the areas where we really should be paying a lot of attention. So there's a couple of examples of species that are pretty insensitive to a lot of the variation in environments that we see driven by fire. That's not really the case for all of them. So this is the leadbeater's possum, which you may know of. It's Victoria's faunal emblem. It's critically endangered. One other thing that distinguishes it from those other species is that it's not technically, but close to being a successional specialist, which is basically a species whose habitat requirements are defined by time since fire and time since disturbance. So they like living in old hollow-bearing trees. Trees take a long time to grow and form these hollows after fire events, so habitat's usually not really suitable for them until a long time after fire. Some of our native rodents have almost the flip side of this. They only like habitat that's been quite recently burnt. But with species like this, if you change the pattern of fire, and particularly with leadbeater's possums, if fires become more frequent, then long unburnt patches of the landscape become increasingly rare and hard to access for the possums, so their populations get much smaller, much more isolated, and they're much more likely to lose genetic diversity and adaptability in the long term. They're also impacted by other processes like logging too, which interact with fire and sort of landscape. So that's all I was going to mention with the animals, so probably close to running out of time. One of the other projects that we're looking at here is not looking so much at the responses of animals themselves to fire, but the foundational species underlying this ecosystem, which is mountain ash or eucalyptus regnans. And I did mention at the start of this talk that a lot of eucalyptus are re-sprouters that can deal quite well with fire. Mountain ash doesn't do this at all, so we get these periodic, really large, high-severity fires in this sort of ecosystem that come through every 50 to 100 years, or increasingly more often these days, and they kill the overstory mountain ash trees. And what happens when the trees are killed is that then they drop seed and you get a new stand coming up, which actually works really well when fires are infrequent, but it takes about 20 years for a mountain ash tree to reach maturity, pending Brenton's results of staring at an awful lot of seed pods and things. So if fires start occurring within a stand more regularly than that, you don't get regeneration and mountain ash are going to disappear from the landscape. To a certain extent, they might be able to rely on seed dispersal or recolonisation to keep their populations going. But there are going to be some pretty serious thresholds reached quite soon about how frequent and how big fires can be before this species actually starts vanishing from the landscape. So Brenton is looking very chirpy and happy with his new climbing equipment there, and slightly less chirpy up the back of the road audience here. Has been doing a lot of work on that for his PhD using genetic data to look at seed dispersal distances, also looking at age and maturity and other sort of adaptations that might give this species some sort of flexibility in response to changing fire patterns. So I'll just show one more slide. I'll leave the mountain ash forest work for there. One of the applications we've got of this work, it's sort of interesting from a nerdy pure science perspective as far as I'm concerned, but in terms of actual practical outcomes, one of the other projects we're involved in is with a non-government organisation called the Australian Wildlife Conservancy that you may be familiar with. They basically manage a lot of land around the country for biodiversity conservation. And we work with them on a project that they call EcoFire, which is up in the Kimberley region, where they're basically trying to reinstate traditional Aboriginal burning practices to benefit sort of native biodiversity conservation and hopefully also have some good pastoralism outcomes from that too. So they're doing a whole lot of different experimental trials of different prescribed fire patterns. And Robin, who's a PhD student up there, who's looking very cool and movie star for the flamethrower, is doing some experimental work and genetic work looking at how the different prescribed fire patterns actually influence population dynamics of this species and which ones we should implement if we want to have the best recovery of some of these native rodents. This is a pale field rat, common rock rat. There's a whole lot of others up in that sort of area that are actually declining fairly seriously. We often think of Northern Australia as a real stronghold for our wildlife, but they're not doing too well lately, and one of the main reasons for that is thought to be changing patterns of fire. So I'll leave it at that, but I just wanted to give that example briefly because I think it's a nice case study of genetics sort of coming out of the lab and being involved in practical environmental management. So thank you.
In my section, I'm going to talk about forensic application that you can use for studying wildlife, wild animals, and species like my PhD research about large macaws in the Peruvian Amazon. So let's see first the victims. The victims are the macaws. These are basically large parrots. They belong to the Psittaciformes order, the parrots. And in a recent study, we just showed like this group of birds are one of the most endangered bird group. So they're facing a very high extinction risk. And if you just look at the macaws, they're actually looking quite bad. Six of them already extinct, extinct, and one extinct in the wild. and you can see quite a few species that are threatened according to the IUCN categories. Macaws you can only find in the neotropics in South America and Central America, so I had to go all over there to study them. The crime, is the major threats to parrots and macaws, are actually us, or the major threats. So the ogre population, the boom of human population, the growth of agricultural lands, cutting trees and forests, the selective logging of large trees in the Amazon, it's quite harmful for these macaws and all parrots, because they are secondary cavity nesters, which means that they occupy tree hollows in large trees, and if mostly in forests. And if you talk about macaws in South America and Central America, they usually occupy large trees in the rainforest, like very large and rainforest trees. And they are also very, very popular in human society, so we keep many parrots as pets. So the illegal poaching or pet trade is another unfortunate issue that's going on still in the neotropics and the developing countries. So for my PhD student, I had to go over where they live in South America to study them in the field. The only way to access this land is by plane. So I went to Peru, the southeastern Peruvian Amazon, and once you on land, the only way to get around the rainforest is basically using the very excessive river system. So that was our little crime scene unit, which was just a motorized canoe. So we used that to go and find nesting places of macaws. And actually, surprisingly, it worked very well, because we got in the most remote little streams in the rainforest, even in this very, very isolated valley near to the foothills of the Andes. But once you go off the boat and start walking towards the forest, there are like no trails, no humans living there, so it's very, very dense and impenetrable forest. But sometimes you can find quite large trees that result to be a macaw nest, so that's going to be one of our crime scene, the first crime scene. And the other places we are looking for were the so-called clay lakes. In South America, these are large balls of clays next to the river edge, where macaws and other parrot species are coming very, very often, almost like every day, hundreds of them, to eat the sodium-rich soil. So, of course, there are no crimes in these scenes, but you will understand why we call them like that. So to collect evidence, what we need, the first line of the evidence, to find these nests where they live, so they home. We need to climb up to these often 30, 40 meters high cavities and look inside. We use kind of a mountain climbing or rock climbing equipment, and then we get the chicks out of the nest and take some blood samples that we can ship back to the laboratory for further analysis. The second line of evidence, we collected these clay lakes where macaws go every day, and they also leave the feathers behind. So feathers are DNA source, like, for example, hair samples for humans. And if you look at this closer, this part of the feather, if you cut it out, there's a small drop of dry blood inside, which has a really high content of DNA. So we can use that to extract the genetic material, both the blood and the feather samples. So we have the evidence. And then this material we can use an analysis, a forensic style analysis, that's called the genetic tagging or genotyping. So genotyping is widely used in forensics to the unique identification of individuals. Like, for example, the CODIS database of FBI, they're using 13 hypervariable genetic markers, so-called microsatellites, to human cases to identify individual humans. In Australia, the NCBI DD is using 9 established genetic markers. So we're using this very same type of genetic markers, the microsatellites, that we developed specifically for macaws. We used 11 of these genetic markers, and we can use that to actually differentiate each individual, not just groups of individuals. And if you do resampling one side every time, you can also use that for estimating population size. For example, if you find 6 feathers at a clady and just look at them, they look very, very similar. You can't really tell like how many actual individuals visited that clady that left these samples behind. But if you use this genetic tagging technique and analyze the DNA, you can tell that, for example, this and this, these 2 feathers are coming from the same individual, so that's actually just one individual. And if you do it for everything, you can see that there are these 6 feathers are coming for like 4 individuals. And of course, we can also use molecular sexing, so we will also know what's the sex of these individuals first, so we can use that for demographic data analysis as well. And if we do other, like, more extensive search of these feathers and genetic samples, we can also answer different other population genetic questions. For example, if there's any sex bias dispersion in the population, what's the relatedness within these groups of macaws visiting different clinics, whether they're family groups, for example. And if we look at the whole population, whether they are inbreeding, what's the genetic structure of the whole population, is there any gene flow between these different groups, etc., etc. So it's a very useful technique for biology as well. So I mentioned you, if you go back to these sites, the clinic, like regularly, and then you collect samples again and again, then you basically do a very similar thing that's called the capture mark recapture, when you actually capture bird, band them, and then recapture them, and then try using this data with recomplicated statistics to estimate and interpolate for the whole population and see what's your population size in that region. So we did the same thing, just using these feather samples as the genetic source. And like, if we went there 2 weeks later and we find some individual that we already identified 2 weeks earlier than we like knew that already, this individual came back to the same clinic, and we also had like 10 new individuals that week, etc., etc. So if we repeat this over and over again, we can have an estimation of the whole population size visiting those areas. So a few things that we find. The maximum time between these recaptures, that we call as genetic recaptures, identifying the same individual over time, was more than a year. So actually, macaws are coming back to these sites and more attached to these clinics. But surprisingly, the maximum distance between the recaptures was only 30 kilometers, which is a rather restricted area of range, because we also have information about satellite tagged macaws and follow them, and they actually fly very, very far away, hundreds of kilometers to Bolivia or Brazil, but they always come back to the same breeding site. We also made some group estimates. It depends on the clinic. It was between 25 to more than 300 individuals coming back to the same clinic. And if you combine this with density estimates from one region, you can have like an estimated area that these birds are visiting these sites. And if you have a look at the whole structure of the study site, we sampled quite a few regions, and we find that, for example, this population that we call Kambano was quite different genetically from the other populations, although it wasn't like much, much further away than any of the other populations. So we also used GIS maps, and these maps are taken by the Carnegie Flying Observatory, and tried to explain the genetic structure that we saw using landscape models. So this we call the landscape genetic study, when you're actually combining two different science. And we find that only one model explained the genetic diversity, and that was the elevation. And if you see that this group of macaws, or this population, is isolated by these the footies of the Andes, so we imply that probably mountain ridges could restrict the gene flow, even these large, very large birds that can fly hundreds of kilometers away, but mountain range could somehow restrict them and contribute to a more isolated population. So the take-home messages of this talk is that parrots are a very highly threatened group of birds. So the focused conservation management is important for many species. And if we use genetic-based techniques like these or others, we can spare lots of time, not just spending years and years in the field to try to figure out and capture these birds where they go, and a huge amount of information we can recover just looking at the genetics. And this information can also help the conservation of these species that scientists can call conservation genetics. Another application of these are for identifying species, so the taxonomic uncertainties, like David talked about, the possums, like you know whether two different groups are different species, or whether any populations are higher risk than other populations, so we can also define management units, which population like require more attention or more protections than other, like isolated macaw population in that valley. And also for reintroduction, we can select which individuals contain the highest diversity to reintroduce into the wild. And also you can have an actual real forensic application as well, just looking at the wildlife trade and try to figure out where the different kind of like meat, bush meat, or like whale meat is coming from and what kind, what species they are. So thank you very much, and I next.
Okay. As Kurt said, my name is Xenia. I graduated from FENA with honors last year, and now it's going on auto. Is that okay? Let's start again. Why is it doing that? Apologies. And so what I'd like to talk to you today about is a little bit about seaweed, a little bit about walruses and Vikings, and it's going to keep jumping ahead, and narwhals, and what I find really exciting, and as a student, and I'll be starting my PhD soon, what I find fascinating and thrilling about genetics and what it can offer us. So my research in honours was looking at this species, Davillea podotora. Now, for those of you who are, it's going to keep doing that, those of you who are familiar, it's found on very wave-exposed rocky coasts of southeast Australia, particularly around Tasmania. And seaweed's one of these tricky groups, particularly this brown macro algae, can grow to 10, 15 metres long, 75 kilos. They're massive individuals. But they're tricky because they've got a relatively simple body plan, but it's very plastic, meaning it responds a lot to the environment in which it's found. And what has been occurring with the rise of genetics and being able to look at differences between individuals is what, much like possums, what we previously thought was just one species is turning out to be multiple. And so when I was considering an honours project, Creed, my supervisor, and Sam was my other supervisor, mentioned that they'd found through some preliminary genetic investigation that there seemed to be two reproductively isolated groups within what we consider to be this one species. But we can't tell them apart based on what they look like or where they're found. In fact, they occur within centimetres of each other, and yet it seemed like they weren't interbreeding for 2 million years, which by all intents and purposes gives an idea of them being considered separate species. So my project was to go down to Tassie and have a look at over 200 individuals and see if, by actually sequencing individuals, whether we could pull apart differences in how they look and where they occur. And so this phenomenon is normally called cryptic species or cryptic species complexes if there's several of them, because although genetically they're different and reproductively isolated, we're unable to tell them apart. So I'm just going to pull it. I don't know what it's going to do to me. So this is a tree that was created. So basically by taking the genetics, I looked at nuclear and mitochondrial, so two organelles, to confirm which species each individual belonged to. and the degree of difference across all of Tasmania confirm that the lineages could be considered separate species. So if you compare that to other brown macroalgae that we've given species status, there was a similar difference in genetic difference. So this led me quite excitedly to come up with a new species name, which I changed off of my thesis and is now proposed as Davillia amethyae. But basically, each individual was confirmed to one of these two groups, and based on that, once I knew whether the individual was Davillia protatorum in its true sense, or the other form, Davillia amethyae, which... sorry, this is going to... Davillia amethyae, which I proposed, we're now meant to be up to here. So this is just a visualization of all of the ecological, so I looked at things like depth and the degree of wave exposure that they experience. Based on that ecology, as well as how they appeared, how similar they were. So if each of these dots represent an individual, the pink circles were those that were found to be Davillia amethyae, and blue triangles were those to be found Davillia protatorum. And so if you just consider, don't ignore the axes, this is just a multidimensional space, but if you just imagine that the closer two symbols or individuals are to each other, the more similar they are, and these circles represent sort of overall similarity, they're 95% confidence intervals, but they're basically saying where the majority of that grouping belongs. You can see that there are some individuals which are characteristic of either species, but there's this huge degree of overlap, and that overlap is saying that those individuals, although they're genetically different, we can't tell them apart based on what they look like or where they're found or how they're found, the environment in which they're occurring. So this raises and challenges our traditional sense and concepts of species, how to define them, how to delimit them, and how to identify them, and also makes it really difficult for anyone in the field, because the only characteristic I found that was definitive between the two was these little branches only occurred on the juveniles of this particular species. But that's not helpful if you've got an adult, and it's not helpful if it doesn't happen, because then you still don't know which one it belongs to. So it poses difficulties about species. The other thing is, by using the genetics, similar to work that's already been discussed, you can look at the geography of where those species occur. And interestingly, Davillia amethyae occurs on the east coast of the mainland, Davillia protatorum only on the west, but they co-occur all around Tasmania. And I'm not going to go into the details, but much as Creed introduced that there was changes in land connectivity and sea level with the Pleistocene glaciations that occurred recently, you can get and develop theories of changes in current, changes in connectivity, potentially resulting in areas becoming inhabitable and local extinctions, which may drive divergence and cause speciation occurring. So it's really also interesting to start toying with ideas of how species are formed, because we have the genetic insights into where they're occurring and looking at their geography. So before it jumps ahead, this is then leads on to what I'll be doing next, which is I've accepted a PhD which will be looking at ancient DNA, and I think this is super exciting. It's being able to extract DNA out of specimens that are thousands of years old, and not only just being able to reconstruct based on what we currently have that's hidden in the genomes of the species that are alive today, but to look at the genomes of those that existed thousands of years ago. So my project will focus on walruses, which will be a change from the plants that I'm used to, and I also compare them with narwhals and look at how, for instance, societies and cultures such as the Thule, who used walrus meat and blubber for subsistence, but also Vikings who went out hunting walruses for their tusks and hides as prestige goods, how that may have affected the genomes. Did that mean, much like we're seeing in elephants today, where hunting for ivory led to smaller, or the adaptations for smaller tusked walruses or walrusi? What other implications were there? So this is all vague. I can't give you any answers. maybe in 3 or 4 years' time I will. But it's, I think it's so exciting to be able to go back in time through genetics and understand what's changed, not just look at today and infer back to the past. So this leads me on to some broader aspects of what I find exciting about genetics, and that's that you can look at things like, there's a recent study published into the current ivory trade that we have in elephants' tusks, and how through genetic analyses we can discover the provenance and therefore potential trade routes and origins, and this can lead to whole changes in the way we manage organised crime or conservation efforts. It also means we start unpicking the real nuts and bolts of particular characteristics that have been iconic. So back to traditional concepts of evolution, one of the common things is, why does the giraffe have this long neck? And original thoughts were that it stretched, each generation stretched a bit harder for taller and taller leaves, which was quite disproved by Darwin, but it revolutionised by his theories. But now we're actually able to see which genes are changing, which proteins are being coded for, what is the nuts and bolts and the mechanisms for the diversity that we see around us, as well as being able to see into the past, as I mentioned, with ancient DNA. So I think that's the really exciting forefront of what genetics can offer us. And I don't know where my career will take us, and I don't know where all the other careers of environmentalists and biologists who are using genetic tools will take us. But there's some really exciting ideas out there already. There's some answers, but there's so many more questions that we can apply these techniques to. So I apologize about the time. Thanks, Danielle. And thanks
to everyone for their really interesting talks. So we're now going to open it up to questions. We're going to sit on these very scary-looking stools. All right, here's the question.
A question, I think, for Sam. This is about the fires, and I know the aerial shot with all the little valleys. The animals basically coming back out of those later, or was there any survival animals inside burnt zones that come out?
Most of the animals that, so things like the mountain brush-tailed possum and antennas, pretty much survived in situ, exactly where they were before the fire. You know, wind's not a particularly good heat conductor, and things that like hollow there in trees can sit there and do perfectly fine. Some of them that like a lot of dense ground cover, like bush tracks and things, really get trapped down to the refuges, and you have them sort of reinvading and spreading out in the fairly short term afterwards. Whereas we haven't seen many leadbeater's possums since the fire. Dave, one of the guys who worked in the field, spotted one fairly recently. They've been pretty much absent from all the burnt area. So there are some things, particularly those that require sort of, you know, the foliage on the overstory canopy or something that basically they require resources that are only in the unburnt patches. But most of what's kind of come back since the fire has been pretty much in situ. I think they have a remarkable capacity to bounce back in the short term.
Yeah, I had another question for Sam. Just wondering how you control for the myriad other factors that might be happening at the same time as these changes in fire regimes, like, for example, invasive species, I'm thinking feral cats, things like that. How do you know that the effects you're seeing are in response to fire patterns over the last X number of years versus those other factors?
It sort of varies between the studies. So just to pick one minor aspect of your question, so the feral cats issue, I mean, that's, to be honest, in northern Australia, for that last study I mentioned, you almost can't separate feral cats from fire in some ways. One of the reasons why we think a lot of mammals are going down the tubes there is that feral cats are much more effective predators when you get high severity fire going through the landscape, and they seem to have this amazing capacity to live for a really territorial animal to attend 10 kilometres to a fire front and start sneaking around, picking off little native rodents and things around there. So, in some ways, you know, we're not almost trying to separate it in that they go together, because the efficiency of cat predation is tied to fire energy in themselves. People have certainly a lot of effort gone predators when you have lower intensity fire or smaller patch of fires anyway, so you can kind of deal with the thing you can deal with, and that sort of works. Within areas like Victoria, you know, on the time scale that we study these things, I guess we just want to assume that cap predation and things like that are necessarily there in, you know, that time frame. They're probably in there to a certain degree, but I want to assume these days they're part of the environment and change to get to the baseline fire anyway. So hopefully that does a sum of an answer.
Question up
for
that?
Thanks for the whole skyscraper build. I was wondering if anyone knows what kind of progress we made towards telling the age of individuals from today information, what that could give us some of these sorts of questions.
Why are you looking at me? I think I've read some research recently that shows that they're making progress in it, but I don't think it can be done yet. You know, there are genetic changes in people as they age, particularly chromosomes get shorter, but I don't know if there are any markers that they've found that can detect someone's age or an animal's age.
There has been some work on telomere length, I think basically telomere shortening as you get older, and there are one or two things that, you know, sort of out there making big claims about being able to age. People want samples from genetic data, but I don't think they need an awful lot of validation for each case study, so I'm not quite sure about the applicability to anything you can do.
They did some for armor, wasn't it? I think telomeres are quite good, but yeah, they need to like calibrate for which species, just like right now.
Sorry, this one's
at
the microphone, so
we'll take a
question here first, and then you next.
On some similar lines, I'm wondering how developments in genomics have influenced the definition or the understanding of what constitutes a species, and what difference constitutes a species boundary, and whether that's become clearer or less clear.
I think it's changed. So Zini talked about the cryptic species in the Kelp, and they talked about possums that weren't necessarily cryptic but weren't identified before we used genetics. I think we need to use a combination of these sort of traditional techniques, like using the shape and the location of the animal, combined with genetics to try to define species, because either on their own are a little tricky. You know, I've got a student at the moment who's working on single-celled organisms, and he's trying to work out whether the two distinct groups he's got are different species. And all you can do in that case, because you can't see them, is to try to work out how genetically different they are and whether that distance constitutes a species difference. But just like telomere length is different for every species, so you need to do a little bit of groundwork first.
Sometimes the environment does it for you, so the invasion of cantos into Kakadu wiped out king brown snakes, except for the very small king brown snakes, which seem to survive. So someone worked through what's going on there, it turns out that now we have a female king brown snake, which doesn't eat amphibians. It has a different diet. And so that was the environmental process that basically led what's going on with the genetics, basically follow up after that to unravel that story.
Can I ask a question to you? Is the population surrounding the burnt area the same? Are you certain that the same individuals that lived there before are still there, or was it simply that they came into a open area?
On the scale of the fires that we see in Victoria, we do get significant genetic differences over, you know, hundreds of metres or 1 or 2 kilometres, and we can quite easily show, work out the sample individual. Yeah, even outside of that area, it's really genetically different. It's genotypes are really unlikely to have been brought to individuals over there or over there. So it's kind of, I think, as a scientific test, so given the genome or frequency. One aspect in one area, you can work out the likelihood that individual people are there versus there sort of thing. So we can quite confidently determine the animals that are repopulating the various pretty much the same area themselves. And also patterns of movement across the landscape tends to be synergies in the various spatial differentiation you get on the frequencies of the genetic patterns, and you don't see any difference in the sort of pre or post firefox. The other thing as well, England Davies was here about 5 minutes ago, has done a bit of work on getting into really good population model and does lots of computer simulations as well. We sort of worked out over the scale on which we were sampling these animals and the scale on which the fire sampling. The dispersal distance or the different distance of these animals to be inadequate to repopulate this population. These areas in their time frame as well, they were kind of ramping up and they were raised by tenfold. They almost physically couldn't be there in the numbers, but we were seeing sort of three from that. So I think it probably happens on the margins a bit, but I think fire and cover is probably a little bit more muted. But I don't think it just creates this blank slate where you have to survive and take advantage. There are enough animals there in short term to actually repopulate those urban areas as contact
points. The population outside might be restricted by population pressure, and suddenly there's an important area there.
Yeah, but I think that's that type. Actually, I think a lot of cases it is really an open area because there might be much fewer animals, but there are also, unfortunately, much fewer resources as well. So it's not like it's really grass and greener sort of scenario.
Yeah. So, in the case of Sam's agile incomes, they have a special breeding cycle, which means that they reproduce at one time of the year. When all the males then basically lock themselves to death. And so the timing of Sam's work post the fire in February 2009 wasn't until we did the sampling. Mm-hmm. Meant that it wasn't possible for some of these animals to have infilled the area that they had to be from some of these micro refuges. And other work in the US and the Alaska National Park also showed that there were actually, even despite the very intense fire and severe fire and bad fire, just like in Victoria and Sam's work, there was actually these little pockets of nuclei of animals that were persisting, which led to most of the recovery as opposed to things coming from the outside to the water system. And it actually has really important implications for how you manage things. Mm-hmm. So there's a very unfortunate process at the moment where we have a big fire and then there are patches of green that are left over. And so a number of our fire services go through and do blackout burning, where we actually go and burn the bits that didn't burn. And that's a disaster for biodiversity. Mm-hmm. And Sam's work shows comprehensively that can be immensely damaging to the recovery process.
That's quite a relevant question to this stuff we're leaving. I mean, if you look at it, one of our interests was if you don't get subscribed to burn, to kind of burn early in the season in crank conditions. But the idea is generally to burn early, so we're going to look at this really big severe fire late in the season, but we're trying to find out partly whether when you burn these patches, does it actually matter if you live or not, whether you're in a place, if you're worrying about the spacious atmosphere of the fire and therefore leaving little unburnt pockets for animals to recolonize, or you can worry more about how intense the fire is, and you can rely on survival and situ sort of thing for the free population. So, for most of the work down in Victoria, it's very promising, but animals actually don't ground quite as much as we think. They sound locally and stay local, but we're working on a different scale, and it's sort of small fires and smaller scale populations.
Oh, it's so very much under size.
Yeah, whereas, like I said, it was just huge work.
Any other questions?
Is there a magic number when you say, is there a magic number which you say, this is what the animal, if that's 100,000 genes, say, bang, this is a possible, 2,000 genes, is it possible?
People are trying to get estimates of how different genetically different species should be, and there are sort of ballpark, hand wavy figures that you can use for different groups. But it does vary for different groups, and it varies depending on which bit of the genome you're looking at. So for some faster evolving bits of DNA, the mitochondrial DNA. Maybe a 5% difference in the DNA might be a species difference, but in some of the more slowly evolving nuclear bits, it might be more conservative, 1 or 2% between species. But there isn't a magic number, no. Although if you were looking at something, I mean, if two animals are 20% different, then yeah, they're different species. But down to those lower numbers, it's not really so clear.
You don't really trust them with animal A, 100, animal B, 101, special animal A, animal B must be in the same cluster, but animal C, which has 110, is not in the same. So you draw an artificial line. So what happens to what
happens? So that's where using other information, like morphology and environment, can help you to draw that line and make sure it's not artificial. And looking at different genes, so if you're looking at lots of different bits of the DNA and they're all telling the same story, and particularly in Xenia's case where she had two different species that were living right next to each other on the same rock platform but still not having sex, then they're clearly different species.
It can also be interesting to compare the degree of variation within populations. So for instance, not only was there 5% when you were just dealing with mitochondria between those two species, within each species there was less than 1%. So it's saying that individuals within what we're theoretically going to consider a species were quite significantly on a different scale of dissimilarity to what we're considering separate species. So it makes that drawing of the line a little less arbitrary, but yeah, it's still a contentious issue over where species limits lie.
Probably gets a bit more contentious as well when you've got big geographic separation. Mm. You expect them to be different within species as well. Not necessarily if their reproductive data is like if they're thousands of miles apart.
I think this will be our last question before the free one.
I have a really brief question for Chris about the EDA in the States. Do you have an answer to the QE bridge?
So, not yet, but so I haven't just got Scott's full supply list, and it's really extensive, and he took a lot of preserved fruits. And he went through New Zealand, so you know there's a good chance there's kiwi fruit in there. But yeah, I haven't checked to be sure yet that the kiwi fruit matches up. No, you know for sure, no. Scott did not have kiwi fruit.
No, I think it's amazing.
I got really into research in the last few days when I started to find the information, and I was reading a lot of the literature for the early explorers, and Scott apparently was thwarted with scurvy because they had completely wrong information back then. They didn't know that vitamin C existed. They thought there was like a poisonous compound in some foods that gave you scurvy. So they were trying to avoid those foods rather than bringing foods that had lots of vitamin C. They did know that things like fruit and veg were good at fending off scurvy, but again, they thought it was related to this poison, so they didn't realise that, you know, drying or cooking fruit and veg destroys the vitamin C, and so apparently many of the team suffered on both expeditions from scurvy. Alright, so I'd like to invite you all to join us, I think just in the foyer here for snacks and drinks. Thank you very much for being a great audience, and thank you again to the speakers.